I'm Dan Masterson, host of Strategy Talk, where we take a unique view of world events. We report news as history. With me today is the editor of StrategyPage.com and well-known military author, Jim Dunnigan. Associate editor and syndicated columnist, Austin Bay, also joins us.
Welcome, Jim and Austin. Recently, we published a couple of pieces in Strategy Page that talk about Mali, and I'm sure some people in the world, when they hear Mali, they somehow get confused and think it's over in the by Malaysia someplace or where there's islands and like that.
Maldive Islands is what they might.
Right, yeah, they get confused. But Austin, tell us a little bit about Mali.
All right. Well, I made this. It's a geographic joke off of the idiom Timbuktu. And Timbuktu, as an idiom, means a distant or inaccessible place. You know, why, that's like going to Timbuktu. It is actually an idiom I used to hear from some of my West Texas relatives back in the 1950s when I was growing up. Well, Timbuktu is in Mali, Dan, and it got its name, you know, the sense of being inaccessible because at one time it was a major trading entrepot for caravans in the Sahara and also moving down to West Africa. Mali looks inaccessible, and it is kind of, sort of. It's landlocked. It's between Algeria, and then virtually, as I went through in the column, which I'm not going to recapitulate here, but people can go look at it. You've got Niger and Mauritania on the borders, three other Burkina Faso, and then you've got several fragile African states, the coastal states that keep it landlocked. It's primarily desert. It's very, very poor. The northern part is Tuareg tribes, for the most part, Berber people, who resent being controlled by the Southerners. Berbers always resent, and for good reason. Both Jim and I sort of take a pro-Berber stance for a lot of reasons. It's admirable to see a people that can wage a constant guerrilla war for over 2,000 years, because they certainly did. Jugurtha in the Jugurthine Wars with the Romans in the first century BC was a Berber. So there's that internal conflict dimension between the south and the settled south and the nomadic north. Now, what comes into play, and this is something that Jim has been writing about a lot for years, is the so-called Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb. The Maghreb is really the Western Sahara region of North Africa, extending all the way to Morocco, Algeria, and the like, but then dropping down into Mali and Mauritania. And Al-Qaeda in the Islamic Maghreb, AQIM, is the Al-Qaeda affiliate / Islamic State in the Levant affiliate / militant Islamic terrorist organization operating in the area. And, of course, they try to take advantage of any kind of chaos, any kind of grievance that they can incite. I guess the way I wanted to say it is that they try to incite as much chaos based on armed grievance that they can find, because that's the tool that the militant Islamists use globally to stir the pot. And, of course, ultimately, they're looking to topple fragile regimes. Now, Niger is a huge place as well. Niger's got uranium. You may remember the so-called Valerie Flame case about a Niger yellow cake going to Saddam, but it's kind of a narrow neck south of Mali across Niger, and then you get to Nigeria, where Boko Haram commits some of the more sensational war crimes and genocidal acts. They certainly get, they're a ISIL affiliate, Islamic terrorist outfit. We write them about them a lot. They've committed some horrendous crimes, and there is a flow through of contact and support coming from Islamists in radical Islamists in North Africa on down to Boko Haram. Why strategy page covers Mali? Because there's a war in Mali, and it's the suffering is real, and we write about it. I decided to write about it because it's an example of why the global war on terror, just to use the old Bush administration term for it, GWAT, really is a global war. And even in this obscure place, you see the same kind of operational and strategic endeavors on the part of the militant Islamists that you see elsewhere around the world. Pick out an embedded grievance, especially if there are Muslims involved in it, exploit it, arm it, try to co-opt it. Problem is, the Berbers are very difficult to co-opt, and I'm sure Jim's going to talk about that. The Berbers actually get some support from the French, who also operate in there, and to some degree from the UN. One of the problems right now is that the Mali government is not honoring a peace agreement that the UN and France and other Western European nations have, and including the United States, been involved in this as well, tried to forward in Mali between the Tuareg and the Malian government. And the Malian government is crooked and not following through. And the UN, even though the UN Security Council wants more troops, the nations supporting it, providing contingents, don't want to send more troops or provide more aid until the Mali government lives up to its commitments to the Tuareg. And sitting outside of this is Al-Qaeda and Islamic Maghreb looking to stir as much as many problems as it possibly can. So I'll just leave it with that. I guess that's a pretty good geographic sketch and a little taste of the complications in this desert region that's so distant, Dan.
Okay, Jim, why are the French there? How did they get pulled into all of this?
Well, the France stayed very close, more so than any other colonial power, to the countries in Africa that it basically left in the 60s. And when they became independent, they continued to support them. They not only provided, development money and technical assistance, but also, scholarships. In other words, they wanted to keep the French language alive and French culture alive in Africa. But what they also did, which is why they're still there after more than 50 years, is that they also supported whoever was in power up to a limit. In other words, if the local dictators, and they were that until quite recently, and some are drifting back in that direction, they had a coup a threat from someone that the French decided was worse than the current guy, and the French would intervene. Normally, it didn't take much. You send out a few hundred thousand or so French, professional French troops, and that would quickly put an end to most threats. And they are basically still doing that. They, for example, when the Northern Mali underwent one of the periodic Tuareg, which is a branch of the Berber people from North Africa, when they staged one of their periodic rebellions against the Mali government, 90% of which is in the south of the Niger River, where they have water and farming, and 90% of the population, the local Islamic radical groups joined, and they managed to run the Mali security forces out of the north and took control for a year. France went in, and when they decided that it would take too long to get peacekeepers from Africa, there was a big plan. They had the African Union, which has become more active in peacekeeping in Africa in the last decade or so, since the 90s. and they realized this would take too long, and the threat would only grow, and other Western countries were complaining that northern Mali had turned into another base for Islamic terrorists, especially because of what was going on in Libya. France just, you know, in early 13, just led an invasion. They mostly themselves, followed by some African peacekeeping contingents, and eventually some Mali troops when the Mali our armed forces were reconstituted. There was also at the same time a coup in Mali, but that's another story. That was resolved. And the French are still there, basically leading a counterterrorism operation. But what is going on in Mali now is what has been going on in Mali ever since independence. The problem is that northern Mali was never really part of Mali. I mean, Mali was an invention of the colonial period. Now, this is something people often misunderstand. The when the colonial powers went in there in the 19th century, you know, the colonization of Africa only lasted a century or so, because until the 19th century, there was no medical ability to keep Europeans alive in Africa for a useful period of time. In other words, they couldn't get Europeans to go down there and basically run some of those areas. Some of them, you know, had gold and other, you know, valuable minerals and what have you, even in the 18th and 19th century. But they had to trade with the locals from the coast. That's where the African slave trade came from. Again, people forget that all those slaves that were, you know, sold to the American and British Western slavers were enslaved by fellow Africans who, instead of using them for their own purposes, you know, found that the Europeans would pay a higher price. And that's still going on in Africa. But again, that's another story. The problem was that France decided, well, let's include this northern part of the colony, which, you know, when the French went in there and established their Mali, you know, colony, they incorporated the populated area south of the Niger River, but they also grabbed the portion north, Timbuktu, the fabled Timbuktu caravan town and what have you, and a few other towns up there. And the majority population up there was Tuareg, which are basically North Africans who have gone, you know, basically related to the ancient Egyptians. That's all the Berbers. You know, we say, what happened to the ancient Egyptians? Well, a lot of them are still in Egypt, but a lot of them didn't go to Egypt, and they basically spread throughout North Africa. These are what the Romans called the Numidians, and people misinterpret that as Africans. Well, they were technically Africans, but they weren't black Africans. They were basically sort of Semitic people. But anyway, the Tuareg never got along with the black Africans, the Bantu people, to the south, which has been a problem for thousands of years. The only reason the Muslims were already there when the Europeans showed up was because the Muslims took the long approach. They basically went native. In other words, they took local wives, and they basically created a half Arab, you know, half Bantu population, which had become Muslim and become Arabized, as it were. And this is why in many countries, you know, south of the Sahara Desert, the northern part of the country is Muslim. In many cases, they're not, you know, Africanized, you know, Arabs, as it were. They're just Bantu, but they accepted Islam. But the southern portions, which the Arabs had a hard time, you know, conquering, even with their blended population, as it were, except that Christianity, or are still practicing the ancient, you know, what we call paganism, but the, you know, the ancient traditional beliefs in Latin. Mali is almost entirely, you know, Muslim, but they were never really radicalized. In other words, most African states follow less strict form of Islam, which is actually the situation outside of the Middle East. Indonesia, you know, Southeast Asia in general and what have you, the form of Islam which basically created Al-Qaeda and ISIL and what have you, this is the Arab conservative Islam, Wahhabism. But outside of Middle East, the locals adopted a much milder form of Islam, which is not nearly as chaotic and violent and what have you. Anyway, at this point in northern Mali, some of the Tuareg had basically the Tuareg separatists had formed their own Islamic radical groups, which were affiliated with Al Qaeda, and some of them are now affiliated with ISIL. The combination of all these Islamic fanatics coming in, as well as the Tuaregs, who are no slouches when it comes to violence, but they're not as suicidal as the Islamic terrorists are. They won the place, and the French went in there, and they knocked them out. But the Islamic terrorists are still there because a small percentage of the population, and by the way, the majority of the population of northern Mali was Tuareg, but the biggest minority was Arab. The Arabs have been down there for centuries as traders and specialists and what have you. Some of them have just settled down. You know, it's another sinking desert, and they were familiar with that and what have you. There's still a problem up there, so the French are still up there. But the main problem with Mali is not Islamic terrorism. That's the one you hear the West is most concerned about. But what the Africans are most concerned about, and this is one thing that fed the Tuareg rebellions, was the corruption. In other words, the Mali government, which is dominated by the 90% of the population south of the Niger River, got all the foreign aid, and hardly any of it went to the north. Now, part of it was because, hey, you bad boys up there, why should you get any of this money? You'll just buy more weapons and shoot at us. But it was also basically because, the government stole most of it. Nobody in Mali, Tuareg or Bantu, was getting much of this aid money. And that was endemic throughout Africa, throughout the world, really. And, it's only since the Cold War ended that people started to analyze the uses with foreign aid was put, and they realized, and I was hearing this even in the 80s when I was trying to figure out how the Soviet Union worked and what have you. So I was working with a lot of financial analysts on Wall Street who had access to a lot of data, which was not classified, but it was hard for even a journalist to run down. And one guy went in looking at bank transfers and what have you. Again, unclassified, non-proprietary data, but if you were in the financial, markets, you could get access to this stuff. And he found, my God, the money that has gone into certain countries that got a lot of foreign aid matched the cash exports. In other words, the crooks were exporting the aid as fast as it came in. And it was sort of a joke to many African despots, and corrupt officials. They would brag. This was reported in the open media, but it never became a meme, as it were, a constant story you would keep repeating. One Arab leads in terms of corruption. He says those Middle Eastern pipers, they might take 10%, 20%, 30%. We take 90%. Can you beat that? Well, no, you can't. But when it comes to revolution, you better have a exit strategy. Even though the Europeans, the banking countries, as it were, the countries that control the United States and European countries that basically control the international banking system, and the best places to go for asylum, as it were, exile, if you're a wealthy politician from anywhere, started cracking down on that. The secret bank accounts, most people know about the Panama Papers. Guess who shows up prominently there, aside from a few American politicians, a lot of African, Asian, Chinese, and what have you, the usual suspects, plus a few you didn't even know existed. So it's harder to be a thieving African politician, but they still do it. Part of it's tradition. In other words, when the French left, they left the idea of democracy, liberty, equality, fraternity, all that stuff. Well, it sort of works in Europe, but it never really had a chance of taking hold in places like Africa. And Africans will admit this because the tribalism is very strong. It's basically gone in the West. You know, the only remnants we have are like the Scottish clans, which are more of a social organization than, you know, a political, you know, financial, you know, organization. Albania has problems with the clans. The Kurds have problems with the clans and corruption and what have you. But Europe, you know, basically, and especially in America, is saying, you know, hey, what's that? You know, if you're not familiar with it, it doesn't exist, you know, especially in the United States. But the French knew better, and they tried to, as best they could, to get the democracy going, but they're throwing up their hands, and now they're only in there, really, to deal with the Islamic terrorism. Because the fundamental problem, nobody has a solution for. I mean, the Africans themselves, especially with the internet and some increases in you know, living standards, you get more of a middle class, lower middle class, whatever you want to call it. The people who can afford to internet access and to demonstrate and to basically exert political pressure, they're screaming for reform, and you're hearing about that, but it's not actually happening yet. And it isn't happening in Mali. So the big problem in Mali, which keeps which keeps feeding the, especially the Islamic, you know, violence, is the corruption. And that's what's keeping it going more than anything else, you know, up north. And it doesn't get reported. You know, for some reason, it's become a meme, shall we say, in the West, that evil colonialists, you know, are at fault for all this. But it's not evil. Actually, if you go at it from an accountant's point of view, the colonialists did a lot of good. They did some horrible things. But they basically introduced a new culture. They are responsible, and this could be a backhanded compliment, for the population explosion in Africa, because they introduced some public health measures which vastly cut down the infant mortality, you know, rate and you know, death rates in general. Now, they were still, your life expectancy was still lowest in Africa, but it was much higher after the colonial powers arrived than it had ever been, and that created a population explosion, which, again, no good deed ever goes unpunished, which the West is blamed for. You know, you can't win. But the problem there is the money and who gets it, and the right people aren't getting it. Now, that is slowly changing. These things can't be changed overnight. And the Western, the donor states, which are still overwhelming the Western states, they are under pressure to put more restrictions on the aid. Now, some of them don't want to do that because it means telling people, no, we won't send you food. Now, a lot of them are doing it, but they're doing it very quietly. When you hear news stories about starving African refugees, you know, the UN is calling for money and what have you. The UN has always been a corrupt organization, but now it's notoriously corrupt. In other words, the corruption is more visible. You know, it used to be, I remember back in the 70s and 80s, at one point, I guess it was the 80s, I was dating a gal from the UN, she was from Peru. And she was just in passing, would tell stories about, oh no, the Chinese, we couldn't do that because the Chinese own that job, or they own those jobs. In other words, the countries that could basically supply the most bribes owned a lot of what went on in the UN. And that included the ability to steal, you know, or to arrange who would get, you know, stolen aid money in the countries it was headed for. The food program, the UN food program, has become such a chronic disaster because of the corruption and the food never getting to the people it's intended to, that a lot of the major donor states just refuse to do it. In other words, the need is worldwide, it's vast, and they decide, well, I'm going to put this food where I know more of it will be delivered. So, again, it all comes back to the money, which nobody likes to talk about. I mean, accounting was never fashionable. But, you know, if you're starving refugee anywhere in the world, especially in Africa or the Middle East and what have you, and the food and donor states aren't coming through, it's not because they're mean-spirited. They want to, you know, of course, the conspiracy theorists there say, hey, they're against the Africans. They're trying to kill us by not sending in food and what have you. But no, they just don't want to waste it. And that is what is basically keeping the Islamic terrorism going, because especially when you have an Islamic population, it's always been fashionable for the young lads to be stirred up by the clerics, the imams. They say, well, Allah, you know, Islam is a militant religion, the only major religion, basically, which is officially, you know, the scriptures give you plenty of how-to business and, you know, how to kill for the cause. Start a holy war and kill two birds with one stone, you know, get a free ticket to paradise, and maybe eliminate these corrupt SOBs. Of course, the problem is, in the few cases where the revolution has succeeded, the religious dictatorship, like in Iran, eventually becomes as corrupt as, you know, whatever they accuse the Shah of. In fact, in Iran, and as in many African countries, people realize they start saying, you know, first quietly and then a lot more loudly, like in Somalia, gee, what if we had the colonial powers back? Of course, the colonial powers won't come back because, you know, before they left, and especially after they left, they did an accounting analysis, which didn't get a lot of publicity, of the colonial administrations. And even with what they plundered, so to speak, and you got, you know, cheap minerals and what have you, it was a losing proposition. Churchill was famous for doing this with India when they were debating about, you know, should we really, you know, give up India, you know, after World War II. And he says, well, what's the accounting aspect of this? And somebody said, well, gee, we never did that. I said, we'll do it. And they did it, and they realized we're losing God knows how much money. And this was political dynamite in Europe, with Britain, which was broke after the end of World War II. So he says, yeah, for, you know, this day, if we try to hang on to it and it gets out, we're losing all this money, and we have been for a long time, you know, forget it. You know, of course, labor got to be anyway. But the fact of the matter is, it's more about corruption than it is about religious fanaticism.
Let me make a point on that. You know, as I mentioned it early on about the corruption of the Malian government and also how that works into the reluctance on the nations providing peacekeeping contingents to provide a plus up despite the Security Council's request. Jim writes about the endemic corruption that feeds so many of these conflicts, but the militant Islamists, Dan, prey upon this, prey, but then the religious pun is implicit because they say, you know, we've got moral values. We won't do this. We'll clean the system up. And as Jim points out, over time, they become crooked anyway. And in the case of the Islamic State in Levant, and actually applies to Al-Qaeda leaders as well, they're bloody thugs who kill anybody who disagrees with them. They destroy economies. Their economic programs are utopian, or, hey, once we get the religion right, everything will work correctly. If that sounds the same pitch that the communists used to say, once we get the dictatorship of the proletariat, all the milk and honey will flow. So they don't have any economic answers, but they do come up and say, you know, we're not going to cheat you, and they use the corruption as a political lever. This is one reason that you'll see it's lost in the morass of the American State Department, and it shouldn't be. But early on, actually, I could say this has been going on since the end of World War II, is that we've had advocates for saying, look, clean up your system, get solid contracts, contract law. Jim might say, well, Austin, you mean British contract law. Well, yeah, that's a good model, the one where enforceable contracts, in other words, rule of law initiatives, but also getting the economic benefits from it. There's been some effect over time, but it's slow. You're dealing with personal connections, individual power, tribal connections, and they undermine the rule of law initiatives. So you end up in kind of a self-perpetuating a cycle, which the locals, well, we're going to run it this way, and if you intrude on us, you're imperialists. Oh, yeah, we want money. Well, maybe you should, clean up your legal system. And you'll do that, you'll remove political grievances as well. So obviously the militant Islamists aren't the only ones who prey upon the corruption and use it as a reason to rally political support. And heavens, it's a legitimate issue to rally political support. It's just in the case of Mali, Al-Qaeda and Islamic Maghreb is one of the beneficiaries of it.
Well, you know, it seems like we always come back to the same three things that
greed, corruption, and the third one just went through.
Tribalism.
Tribalism, yes. So, you know, it's almost like...
A taste, an unfortunate taste for violence. I mean, we avoid the word evil, but the thing is that greed works into that, you know?
Right.
Tribalism doesn't necessarily, but that's not the, at all. As a matter of fact, there's some positive attributes about tribe, but it's, you know, you hit it. Greed and incompetence is another element, Dan, really.
Right.
Austin, you know, makes a point there that something else that doesn't, a real issue that cannot be discussed, is that some cultures are more violent than others.
They are.
We all know about the Gurkhas. And that's a group of people who can
Jim Dunnigan, you cannot say that. You bad man, you saying that.
Well, the Gurkhas are quite proud of it, and many of them have become quite wealthy by serving in the Indian and especially the British Army for centuries. But it also includes the Afghans, which the Special Forces guys, any Special Forces guys served up there, can tell you stories that will not appear on the mass media. Although many, how should I put it, foreign aid organizations, Medicine Sans Frontier, they're familiar with it, and they don't like to discuss it either. I mean, Afghanistan is basically, the Pashtuns have always been, and they still are, a very violent society. And that is simply not, you cannot discuss that in the West.
First edition of A Quick and Dirty Guide to War had a quick look called Mig and Hind Hunting in the Hindu Kush, and it touches it. It provides a few examples of what Jim is talking about, and out of Pashtun culture. I mean, it's, you got to get the first edition, and it didn't make it into the subsequent ones. But what he's saying, they're in there, and it's some of the thing that young men in the Pashtun society do when they learn how to use weapons. And there's an example of it.
Yeah. Well, it's time for us to wrap up, and so we'll talk to you gentlemen next time.
Bye, guys.
Thank you.
Bye.
Take care.